All right, so good evening, Erev Tov. Welcome to Torah Tuesday. This is the week of Parashat Bamidbar, which is for us in English the Book of Numbers. We'll talk about why it's called the Book of Numbers for us in English and why it's called Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness, in the Hebrew Bible. But before we do so, let us open with a blessing before the study of Torah, as well as attach and bind ourselves to our Messiah and to His mind, so that His mind may become ours and ours become His. We become one and we enter into the Torah. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam asher kidishanu bo mitzvotav vesivanu le'asok bidivrei Torah. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with His commandments and has commanded us to be engaged with the words of Torah. Hareini makasher atzmi be'adon Yeshua HaMashiach HaZadik shehu lechem ha'chayim v'ha'or ha'amiti. We hereby join ourselves to the Master, Yeshua, the Messiah, the Righteous One, who is the bread of life, the true light, the source of eternal salvation for all those who hear Him. Amen. If you haven't done so, please do grab a handout at the end of the table. It'll be our guide for Bar Midbar. It's the opening parashat section for the book of Numbers, so to cover Numbers chapter 1, verse 1, through chapter 4, verse 20. And we'll probably spend the first 45 minutes or so in verse 1. Okay, so lots of stuff here in Bamidbar. And again, the idea is I'm trying to set a methodology for you to give you tools to engage this further on your own. But let's do our Hebrew lesson first. It's coming from the Apostolic Scriptures, Revelation chapter 7, the beginning of verse 4. It reads, Ve'eshma et nispar. Ve'eshma et nispar. Now, if you look at Ve'eshma, we have the Vav, the coordinating conjunction, so you can mark that off, meaning and. And we have the Aleph there, which lets us know that this is a verb, and it's first person singular. So it's going to have the I for a subject, and you mark that off, and you're left with Shema. Now, what's Shema mean? To listen or to hear, right? So, and I heard, or and I hear, et. Et is the direct object marker, and the object is mistar, which means the tally, or the counting, or the numbers, the context being like from a census. And so that's our verbal tally, because we're going to actually see where Revelation 7 and our parashat from Bamidbar have a lot of connecting points. One of them is with the idea of taking a census. Okay, so it opens there, Revelation 7:4, with, and I heard the numbers, the tally, the census total. Okay, Vaishma et mispar. So let's recite that together. Ready? Vaishma et mispar. All right, very good. Now, before we actually start looking at the text of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, in depth, I want to kind of set the overall focus for not only this week's parashat, but the entire book of Numbers. Because when you look at the book of Numbers, kind of like what we did with Leviticus, when we said, well, on the outset, what are all these rules and regulations about a priesthood and a tabernacle and furnishings and all these things that it seems so irrelevant? How can we draw any meaning from this? Well, same kind of thing with the book of Numbers. How can we really draw any meaning for ourselves from a bunch of census and number totals and name listings of names? How is any of that actually going to connect to us today? And so I want to kind of set how we read Bamidbar. So in the English, the book of Bamidbar is called the book of Numbers. That's because that's what the Septuagint calls him. And Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. Numbers is a somewhat surprising translation, given that Bamidbar, its historic title, means in the wilderness. Now, when I say in the wilderness, and tonight whenever I say wilderness, I don't want you to think of what you kind of see as woods around here. I want you to think desert. Okay? That's what it's really getting at. So, in the wilderness, in the desert. But aside from the fact that it's historically always been called in the wilderness, or Bamidbar, the title Numbers actually does make good sense. Because tribes and families and individuals are counted several times throughout the book. In other words, it's a book of numbers, most notably at the beginning of the book. So while it is a book about being in the wilderness, it's also about numbers and counting. This recurring theme of numbers, though, raises two questions. Why does the Torah present such a detailed census? Remember, we're going with the assumption that there's no wasted space in the Torah, that everything there is for our times and for all times. So why does it spend so much ink on these detailed census? And given that the Torah speaks to each person in every generation, including us gathered here tonight, what does the detailed census actually have to teach us? So why does it pay so much attention to it, and what does it offer us today? In the 1960s, an individual named Marshall McLuhan, who was a communications expert, coined a very useful and now popular phrase. The phrase is this: the medium is the message. In other words, McLuhan suggested that what we communicate is intrinsically connected in the manner and in the way we wish or choose to communicate it. In other words, it's not just the message. It's how the message is presented. It's who presents it. It's the tone it's presented in. Everything about it. It's not just the message, but also the medium. The medium is not neutral. It not only affects the message, but very often, the medium can become a message in and of itself. One of the lengthy census fundamental messages is that both the nation as a whole and its component parts, tribes, families, groups, heads, individuals, are all exceedingly important and unique. It's one of the immediate things you take from it. Is it's kind of like counting the hairs on your head. The fact that there is a counting going on stresses the importance of the entire system, from its greater macrocosm all the way down to its most minute individual part. That each one of these things are unique and incredibly important. Initially, individuals, families, and tribes are counted. Then another count is recorded of the three tribes that are encamped on the sides of the tabernacle. And then finally, there's a global figure given for all the tribes. The ever larger circles of influence that are physically demarcated by the encampments each have their own dynamic, and every individual person constantly operates within these various contexts, whether it's consciously or unconsciously. And the same is true for us. We operate within our own immediate family, whether it's we just live with a spouse, or we have children, or our parents are living with us, but we all operate within that system, which operates within a bigger system of the family at large, which operates within the community in which we live in, which operates in the state, which operates in the country, which operates in the world. Each of these, we're either consciously or unconsciously operating in these contexts. The Torah chooses to make the medium the message by expressly mentioning each individual, each family, and each tribe in the encampment to reflect the importance that the Torah attaches to every component of the nation, as a part of the whole and as a distinct part. In other words, you're not just an individual. We live in a very individualistic culture and society. You are an individual. You are unique. You have your own gifts, your own giftings by God. But you're also part of something bigger than yourself. And this teaching is especially crucial in today's highly mobile world, where people find it increasingly difficult, both logistically and especially emotionally, to maintain close ties to their families and their communities. So many people today feel cut off from their roots, from their families, from their societies, and from a common set of goals that they share with others. And so either consciously or unconsciously, they perpetually search for a purpose greater than themselves and their immediate needs and desires. It's the great conundrum of our society right now, especially with millennials, Generation X and Y. They crave community, but they have no clue how to do it. They just know they want it. They don't even know how to define it. They wouldn't even call it community, but that's what they want. Because they're so disconnected. So many broken families, so many broken homes, so many moving. You know, people move all over the place now. There's this sense in the younger generations that they don't belong anywhere and they have no connection to anything. And so despite the scientific and telecommunication revolution, where we all live in a global village, and that's certainly true. I mean, I can Skype live with my rabbi friends in Israel. I mean, that's a global village. I mean, never before would someone in Murray, Kentucky have been able to study at the feet of rabbis in Jerusalem. Right? But we can. It's a global village. However, even though we have that, more individuals than ever feel isolated, confused, jaded, and dissatisfied with their life. In other words, the more we have become connected, the more disconnected we've come from family and from community. And so learning how to become part of this and learning how to balance our sometimes conflicting loyalties and attachments in a constantly changing world is no small achievement. So how do you as an individual fit in to a family, a tribe, a group, a unit, an encampment, a nation? This is what the book of Numbers is actually going to help you wrestle with. It actually is going to speak to a problem millennials have. How do you do community? How do you do community? And how do you stay connected to something bigger than yourself without losing the uniqueness that is you? So this is what the book of Numbers actually addresses. The individual in relation to the collective. A lesson in the importance of the individual in relation to the collective. I think a good example of this was conveyed by the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson. For years, he would stand outside of his synagogue every Sunday evening for 8 to 10 hours and personally hand out $1 bills to his followers. And literally thousands of followers would come. So you may think, well, he's given a dollar. That's not a whole lot, even in the 90s when he was giving it out. But if 10,000 people come to see you, how much money have you given out? You've given out $10,000. He would stand out there to greet his followers and give them a dollar and tell them they were to use that dollar for charity. They're to do something for God with that dollar, whether it's to add to whatever they're doing, whether it's go buy a cup of coffee for someone, whether it's buy someone a scone, and so you can enter into a conversation with them about God. He didn't care as long as you put it to work for charity and for God. And he would bless his disciples, his followers. Again, thousands upon thousands, 8 to 10 hours, every Sunday evening for decades. All these people would stand in line and be part of this group only for a few seconds of immediate individual attention. So why did the Rebbe do this? He felt it to be one of the most important things he ever did, because he said that's what personally allowed him to make contact with every one of his disciples, even if it was for a moment, teaching them the importance of giving to charity and offering each person a blessing. Despite the lengthy wait, people would come and wait willingly and patiently, no complaining. Here you can think of in your Gospels, when Yeshua enters a town, what happens? Large crowds come around him, and the Gospels repeatedly say, and he saw them, and he had compassion on them. And then it will say, and he healed all their sick. All. Meaning he stayed there until the last one had come into contact with them. This portion of the Torah contains the secret of emotional and spiritual balance, of finding one's inner equilibrium with a larger community of disciples, as well as a one-on-one individual connection, not only with your Messiah or your Rebbe, but with your family, with your spouse, with your friends. It gives us the key to relate to all of these entities. When we learn to function within all these contexts, family, society, planet, we will discover our place in the world and how to relate to our Creator. For ultimately, we were placed here to repair this world, to put the broken mirror back together. If you remember that discussion of when Adam fell, that pristine mirror shattered, but all the pieces are there. And since then, it's been a process of putting the mirror back together. Each one, as an individual, has a responsibility in this. You have a responsibility as a member of a family in this. You have a responsibility as a member of a community, a nation, a planet. Rav Shaul, the Apostle Paul, speaks of this concept when he speaks of the body of Messiah, body of Christ, body of Messiah, and how each component is just as important as the other. Each member of the body is unique in its size, in its function. Some are much more glamorous than the others, right? The brain is quite sexy, right, compared to the little toe, right? Or the heart, I mean, hey, the heart, that's where it's at. Who wants to be the toenail? But Paul emphasizes, if it's going to work right, if it's actually going to function, because body of Messiah is bottom body of Adam restored, if it's going to move and function right, it's all got to be there. It's all got to be there. From the largest to the smallest, every member there doing their job. It's kind of like the Russian dolls. You got a big doll and you take it out and what's inside? Another one looks like it, another one, another one, and another one. It's the body of Messiah. Some are bigger, some are smaller, some are out front, some are out back, some are eyes, some are noses, but all functioning as a whole. Numbers helps us balance how do we do this and be individuals, and how do we do this and fit into community. And ultimately, how do we do this in relationship with God? Everything is important all the way down to the individual. The census is revealing that. Everything's important all the way down to the individual. That's an overall kind of concept to have when engaging the entire book of Numbers. Because as we go through Numbers, they're going to be in the wilderness for about 39 years. We're going to spend 39 years with this community as they learn to do community. Now, little Bible trivia quiz. How many stops do they have in these 39, almost 40 years? They have 42 stops. Each stop has a name. Pull out your first century toolbox. Names are never just names. And places are never just places. And so each of these 42 stops represents your life and your journey in life and your development as an individual as well as within the community. It's much like counting the Omer. Each one of these stops works on a specific character trait. So these 42 stops taught them how to be individuals in community. And it becomes the fractal and the foreshadow and the prototype for how we are supposed to do it. So it's very applicable. because we stink at doing community. And quite frankly, we stink at being individuals by ourselves. We're lonely, we're restless, we're depressed, we're angry, you name it, as individuals. The book of Numbers gives you the 42-step process to work through. Okay? That's the overarching concept. Maybe we'll deal with some of the 42 stuff in future lessons. I'll work on that. All right, so let's dive into the text. Numbers chapter 1, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses Bamidbar in the wilderness. That's where the portion gets its name, the book gets its name. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first day, on the first of the second month, in the second year, after they had come out of the land of Egypt. So let's spend about half an hour in this verse. You think, can't be done, huh? So the Lord spoke to Moses inside the tabernacle, because it's finally built, right? That's Leviticus. We got the thing built. Prior to the construction of the tabernacle, God spoke to Moses from on top of Mount Sinai. After the construction of the tabernacle, he speaks to him from inside of it. As the story begins in the book of Numbers, 1 month has elapsed since the children of Israel constructed the tabernacle. God routinely speaks to Moses from between the cherubim. The children of Israel are now ready to leave Mount Sinai in confidence that God's presence will go with them. After all, what was the whole point of building the tabernacle? God said, I want a place not to dwell with you, as the English translations say it, but I want a place to dwell in you. And so now they're confident they have this. They carry the tabernacle with them as they travel through the wilderness. And this hits on a theme we've discussed before. The tabernacle was to be a fractal, literally a portable moving fractal of Sinai and the experience of Sinai, of heaven and earth kissing, as well as the Garden of Eden. That's why there's no death inside of there. Remember all those things we talked about and all the rituals that had to go in? It was because it was to be Sinai and the Garden of Eden. It was to be the MASH unit, right? The Mobile Army Surgical Hospital kind of thing. It was to be the MASH unit of God being with and in His people, such as He was in the Garden and as He was at Sinai. So it opens the book of Numbers with these words. The Lord spoke to Moses, Bamidbar, in the wilderness. So Bamidbar, meaning wilderness, the Hebrew name of the book, as we said, it's a good description because the stories in this book of Numbers, this fourth book of the Torah, describes the 39 years of being in the wilderness. But wilderness is an important concept in the biblical text. All through the text. And that's really where we're going to spend quite a bit of time. This is going to open up so many more doors for you when you're reading through your scriptures, when you're reading through the Gospels, when you grasp what wilderness is getting at. The wilderness forms a major component not only of biblical geography. Israel is this small strip of arable land that sits sandwiched between massive Arabian deserts and the Mediterranean Sea. For the Israelite, the world consisted of the Promised Land, beyond which was seemingly endless stretches of hot, dry nothing. The land of Israel contains many wildernesses, rugged and hostile environments that make settlement impossible and make travel very dangerous. And because the wilderness is such a prominent part of the biblical landscape, it plays a larger conceptual role in the Bible. In other words, it begins to take on a metaphorical role beyond just its literal geographical concepts. And so the Bible's poetry, its prophecy, and its narrative are embedded with wilderness concepts. So I want to consider three roles the wilderness plays in the Bible and how they relate to Messiah. There's the wilderness of death, the wilderness of refuge and provision, and the wilderness of revelation. How will you ever know which wilderness you're in? They're all the same, all right? They're all the same wilderness, different aspects of the dying. So let's look at each of these a little bit closer and begin to understand the role of the wilderness in the life of an individual and in the life of a community, and how the wilderness experience shapes how you do community and how you do individual. Numbers chapter 1, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, the tent of meeting, in the first of the second month of the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt. The wilderness is called the wilderness or the desert because of the lack of water. Annual precipitation in the wilderness areas is little to none. And the absence of water and the unrelenting heat combine to make the wilderness essentially uninhabitable. What little life does exist in the wilderness clings precariously to any water source. Natural springs and the desert watering holes and the wadis whenever there happens to be a large rainfall far away and it can momentarily rush through and create a river. The absence of food and water, the blazing heat, the utter emptiness of the wilderness make it a place of death. It's a place to go and die. In Genesis chapter 21, verses 14 and 15, Hagar and Ishmael trek into the wilderness to prepare to die there. Several times in the Torah, the people accuse Moses of taking them into the wilderness in order to die. When the Israelites refused to enter the promised land, the Lord declares this, Numbers 14:35. In this wilderness, they will be destroyed, and there they will die. When Elijah despaired of his life, 1 Kings 19, verse 4, he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, came and sat under a juniper tree, and requested for himself that he might die. The threat of losing arable land to the wilderness was a common motif in the prophets. When Israel, improperly connected, plugged into the wrong socket, what was often the consequence? The shock of that misconnection. No rain. The land becomes like a desert. Likewise, what often comes with proper connection, properly connecting to God, the way God has said, I'm here, here are the highways to me, here are the streets to me, here are the maps to me, and you follow the map, you follow the instructions, you actually listen to your tom-tom. What was one of the results? The desert would blossom, grow like a rose, right? The land would have rain and be fertile. The threat of losing all of this again, but also the wilderness is pictured as a place of unclean spirits. Yeshua says, Matthew 12:43, when the unclean spirit goes out of a man, it passes through the waterless places. That's the wilderness, seeking rest. So when he would exorcise someone, where did the spirit retreat to? The wilderness. The denizens of the wilderness include things like snakes and scorpions. Deuteronomy 8, verse 15. He led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions, its thirsty ground where there was no water. Now, the snakes and scorpions are literal. But remember, the Torah is an onion. So the outer layer is always the literal, means what it means, says what it says, is what it is. But we peel it off, and what are snakes and scorpions? These are the evil spirits, the things of evil, evil influence. Luke 10, verses 18 and 19. Yeshua said to them, and I was watching Satan fall from heaven like lightning. Behold, I have given you authority to tread on serpents and scorpions. Let you know, it's not literal scorpions and serpents there. And over all the power of the enemy, for nothing will injure you. He's giving them the power to do spiritual warfare, because this is when he was sending out the 70 and they were actually making so much progress. He said, I saw the enemy fall. We're winning this battle. And so you can step on those scorpions and serpents. The concept of the wilderness as a place of malevolent spirits also is found in the book of Isaiah. He speaks of the wilderness as a place of unclean animals and birds. Again, that represent the influence of evil. He mentions animals like scavengers that feed on death. Isaiah 13, beginning in verse 21. Desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will also live there, and shaggy goats will frolic. Hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious places. Isaiah also makes this motif in chapter 35. His description of unclean animals as unclean spirits that haunt the wilderness are also echoed in the book of Revelation, when it speaks of Babylon becoming, quote, a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. Revelation 18, verse 2. When Yeshua went out into the wilderness after his immersion, he encounters the Lord of the unclean spirits who tempts him. So as we look to the wilderness as the concept of the wilderness of death, Yeshua becomes our guide. You know, it's never a good idea to decide to climb Mount Everest without one of your local guys there to take you up there. It's never a good idea to go into the wilderness without a guide, someone who knows how to get out of there, who knows where the watering holes are, who knows where the shade is. And so Yeshua has gone before us so that he may lead us through the wilderness, where his rod and his staff will comfort us, because he has prevailed over the wilderness, as well as the unclean spirits that lurk in the wilderness places. So we have first the idea of wilderness as a motif for death. But then the wilderness also in the scriptures has a motif of refuge and provision. Numbers chapter 1, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness. So though the wilderness is a place of death, it is also a place of refuge. Those seeking to escape pursuit find the wilderness to be a safe place where they can hide among the caves, or perhaps those pursuing them are like, he's crazy. He just went into the wilderness. I'm not following him into the wilderness. He'll die anyways. Hagar ran into the wilderness, not only to die, but to get away from Sarah. When Moses fled from Pharaoh, he fled into the wilderness of Midian. In their flight from Egypt, the children of Israel fled into the wilderness. To escape King Saul, David repeatedly took shelter in the wilderness. Elijah fled to the wilderness of the Negev to escape Jezebel. To avoid public attention and public arrest, Yeshua and his disciples hid out in the country near the wilderness. John 11, verse 54. In the vision in Revelation 12, the woman who was Israel escapes the dragon, who was Satan, by fleeing into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God. Revelation 12, 6. Though the wilderness is a dry and waterless place, it is therefore the prime real estate for miraculous provision. The absolute deprivation caused by the wilderness requires what of someone who's in the wilderness? Complete and utter dependence on God and God alone, because nothing else is going to get you through this. So the fact that it is a place of death makes it prime for the place of miraculous provision. In the wilderness, that is where God provides for his people. When Hagar despaired in the wilderness, prepared to die of thirst, Genesis 21:19, God opened her eyes and she saw a well of water. In the wilderness, he provided shelter for Israel, a cloud over them, a day for shade, a fire by night. He provided manna and quail for food and water from a rock. Hosea 13, verse 5, I cared for you in the wilderness, in the land of drought. When Elijah fled into the wilderness, God sent ravens with bread to feed him twice a day. After Yeshua fasted in the wilderness, angels attended to him and ministered to him and provided for him in the wilderness. Revelation 12, the woman, again Israel in the wilderness, 12, verse 6, so that there she would be nourished for 1,260 days. How many years is that?
3.5 years.
How many months is that?
42.
Oh, my goodness. There's your title of the book of Numbers. Why did it say 1,000 years? It's telling you it's a wilderness trip. There's 42 months, 42 stops in the wilderness. So as we are in this wilderness of refuge and provision, again, we must realize we can't go it alone. And so our Messiah is our refuge, our provider. Though he may lead us into the wilderness, he will also protect us, conceal us from the enemy, provide for us, just as he provided for the thousands that followed him from the Galilee. And then there's the motif of the wilderness as revelation. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness. The wilderness is a place of spiritual revelation. Those in the Bible who are seeking a vision, or who are seeking an encounter from God, or who are seeking a word from God, go to the wilderness to find it. Partly because it's a place of death. You certainly die to self. It's a place of refuge and provision. It's going to make sure you don't have anything else you're leaning on. And so it's the place to go to find God. With the rest of the world's fleshly comfort stripped away, the ascetic necessity and stark lines of wilderness experience will bring us face to face with our Creator. While shepherding sheep in the wilderness of Sinai, Moses saw a burning bush and received revelation. The greatest revelation in human history, the Epiphany at Sinai, occurred in the wilderness. Moses undertook several 40-day fasts in the wilderness and wrote the whole Torah in the wilderness. Elijah fasted 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness before arriving at Sinai to seek a word from God. Elijah needed a word, so he went into the wilderness. In fact, he went all the way back to Sinai, hoping to get a word, or Moses got a word, only to hear God say, "Not here. Already done that here. You're going somewhere else." The prophetic words of Yochanan, John the Baptist, comes forth as a voice of one crying in the wilderness. John, Yochanan, lived all of his life in the wilderness. And after Yeshua's immersion, Mark chapter 1, verse 12, what does the Spirit do to Yeshua? The text is so powerful in the original. It throws him, it picks him up and throws him into the wilderness. He doesn't just casually go into the wilderness. The best translations that I've seen will say impelled him, you know. But the idea is, at his immersion, at his baptism, he is anointed as the Mashiach. He is anointed as the Messiah. And this is when everything really kicks in. Well, if we're going to take his human nature seriously, let's envision this. At 30 years old, you get the nod on the shoulder from your father saying, "You're it, boy." Everything that the prophets and everything that were foreshadows of, it's you. It's go time. You're it. You got 42 months. You ever notice that? The ministry of Yeshua is 42 months? How many journey spots are there? Okay. You got 42 months. You're about to go on your own wilderness, my son. What do you think his human nature thought? I need to get this right. I need to communicate. We got to talk. And where does he go to talk? Where does he go to get his revelation? He goes to the wilderness and then takes a 40-day fast. Yeshua is our conduit of revelation. He's the one that passed through the great wilderness of our human experience, our 42 places, and his words are not his own, but his Father speaking through him. He is our burning bush. And so as we enter into this book of the Bible, this book of Numbers, Bamidbar, in the wilderness, remember that wilderness in the Bible is not just the geography and the geographical concept of it, but it's also the metaphorical concept of these things I just described to you. Therefore, ask yourself now, as you're entering into this book, what or where is my wilderness? What is it in your life that seems to be killing you, sucking the joy out of you, draining you of vitality, destroying you physically, emotionally, and spiritually? Where in your life are you literally dying, thirsting? Where are you about to waste away? The book of Numbers reminds you that the wilderness isn't just this place of death and despair. That exact same place that can kill you is also the place where you find refuge, provision, and revelation. So, in other words, it's in that wilderness of your life. See, we live in a culture. We live in a culture that's anti-wilderness. We will do anything and spend any amount of money, and we will go to extreme limits to avoid discomfort, pain, anything that's just not convenient and comfortable, we will avoid at all costs. Yet, the message from the book of Numbers is, where are you most likely to experience God? In the very places we will spend and bankrupt ourselves to avoid. The wilderness. It's the wilderness where you will encounter God unlike any other place. If the wilderness is what will teach you to trust God, to love God, to rely on God. And it's the wilderness that will also, that's the individual, it will also teach you how to live and work in community. Because if you're in the wilderness in a community or in a group, if you don't work together and you don't figure this out and you don't get past the silliness, you're all going to die. So the wilderness is the perfect environment to encounter God. That's why the prophets always go to the wilderness to encounter God. Yeshua went to the wilderness to encounter God. How many times is he wandering off into lonely, out-of-the-way places? His crucifixion, that's a wilderness. So the book of Numbers addresses this. Notice, again, all people, including Yeshua, go to the wilderness to find God. And yet, that's the very thing we fight tooth and nail to avoid doing. So the book of Numbers gives us the roadmap for the wilderness. That's why it's relevant. But it does it in story form. I'm not saying the stories aren't true. The stories are true. That's not the important thing. The important thing isn't proving they're true, isn't proving it's historically accurate. That's so Western. The story is, the medium is the message. It's your roadmap in a story. When you want to teach a 5-year-old a life lesson, what's a very powerful way to do it? Tell them a story. It can be a true story. Well, when I was younger and all that. It can be a true story, but story does it. And so, Numbers is your story. Their story is our story. First Century Toolbox. It becomes your fractal of your journey through life. Your 42 stops. You'll be blown away how often 42 occurs in your scriptures. It may come in 1,200 whatever days. It may come in different ways of saying it. 42 is all over the place. 7 times 6. Okay, that's your matrix for it. These things happened as examples. Numbers chapter 1, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness. So wilderness, whatever it is, it's the place of refuge, provision, and revelation. It is not necessarily, therefore, a bad thing. Since it requires us to rely on God, it can nurture spiritual health. In fact, the prophets would sometimes look at the wilderness experience nostalgically. You know how we like to do that. Once we're through something, we romanticize it a little bit, as if it wasn't like hell on earth, and we complained and moaned and griped the whole time through it. Like maybe you went on a vacation with 12 of your cousins and everyone in your family and stayed in a 2-bedroom condo all together. You know, 7 years later, you're like, remember that time? Wasn't that awesome?
Yeah.
The prophets do this with the wilderness. In fact, the prophets look at the wilderness as the courting period. The period where God was romancing them and wooing them. Jeremiah 2, verse 2. Go and proclaim in the ears of Jerusalem, saying, thus says the Lord, I remember concerning you the devotion of your youth, the love of your betrothed, your following after me in the wilderness through a land not sown. God's there inviting them, kind of like they're married and they're having the seven-year itch issue, and Israel and God as spouse aren't getting along and they're fighting, and Israel's kind of moved out and staying with some relatives. And God's saying, look, remember when we first started dating, the fun we had? Do you remember that? Remember when we first met? Remember our first date? That's what Jeremiah's saying the wilderness was. That's where we dated. That's where we fell in love. It's where we learned to love one another. It's where we learned how to relate individually in community with one another and with God. Hosea 2, verse 14. Behold, I will allure her, and I will bring her into the wilderness and speak kindly to her. Again, the whore wife has gone off, but the husband is pursuing and saying, I'll bring her to the wilderness, and then she'll remember. The wilderness, it'll first seem like a place of death. It'll first seem like the worst place in the world to be, but it's going to be the place you fall in love with me all over again. God, in fact, instituted the Feast of Tabernacles, or Sukkot, as an annual remembrance of the wilderness experience. Sukkot, you build a temporary outdoor structure and you sleep outside, and you eat your meals outside and all that, as a reminder of this wilderness experience. And it's strategically placed right after the harvest, when the Israelite would have been tempted to enjoy a sense of success and abundance. God wanted the people to remember the historic wilderness experience of their forefathers. So right after the harvest, right after, you know, the biggest sale day of the year, that's when God would say, let's go out into the wilderness for 7 days, just so you are reminded that I'm really behind all of this. God wants us to remember the days in the wilderness, lest we forget who our true provider is. Deuteronomy 8:17. Otherwise you may say in your heart, my power and my strength of my hand, that's what's made this wealth. Deuteronomy 8, Moses warns Israel against success and prosperity in a manner that would harden their hearts, causing them to forget God. And he reminds Israel that God led them through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions, its thirsty ground. He reminds them of the water from the rock and the manna from heaven. And of course, Shaul tells us the rock was Messiah. Yeshua tells us he was the manna. Throughout the book of Numbers, a standard plot line emerges. The Israelites become dissatisfied. After all, the wilderness experience is taxing. They complain or rebel. God becomes not happy with the disconnection. God becoming angry is again metaphor for they, in their anger, are deciding, I'm plugging it in this one anyways because I want to. Moses then intercedes. The people repent. And several episodes in the book are built upon that simple theme. Obviously, God wants his people to remember the lessons of the wilderness. And so Rav Shaul says in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 6, now these things happened as examples. There you can insert in your FIV translation. These things happened as fractals for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they did. In other words, Shaul is telling us that the story in the wilderness in the book of Numbers is our story, our life as well. It's kind of like, I don't know if you saw the cartoon that was on the overhead before class when it had an individual saying, the book of Numbers, who wants to read a book full of whiny people that complain whenever anything doesn't go their way or doesn't go exactly like they want? And the other guy says, tell me about it. We need something relevant. All right? No whiny people in here. But it does teach community, because in a church or congregation, It can have 200 vibrant souls. It only takes one naysayer, stick in the mud, grumpy, whiner, you know, just, and it kills, it kills it. It'll kill it. That's where we have to, as a community, take our responsibility and say, you can get in line, or you can hang on the outside of the camp until you're ready to get in line. We're not gonna send you to the jackals yet. We'll make sure you're safe, but you aren't dwelling in the tents. Because it festers, it's cancerous. You'll see that in the book of Numbers. Verse 2. And we're going to do all four chapters tonight. Take a census of all the congregations of the sons of Israel. Take a tally, that word from our Hebrew lesson. All the sons of Israel by their families, by their father's households, according to the number of names, every male head by head. There are several times when the children of Israel counted in the Bible. The sages enumerate that there are 9 such instances in your scripture. But what's the perfect number? 10, right? So, if there's 9, what do you think the sages determine? When's the 10th one going to happen? When Messiah, son of David, is reigning, he will be the final king that makes the final census. And they quote Jeremiah 33, verses 13 through 15 as proof. In that passage, the righteous branch of David springs forth to execute justice, righteousness on earth. And then the land of Israel is re-inhabited. The flocks will again pass under the hands of the one who numbers them, counts them. Jeremiah 33, 13. So they base it on there's 9 recorded instances, but Jeremiah speaks of a time when all will be restored, messianic era type. Jeremiah 33, you're getting all over the new covenant kind of talk. Then there will be the one who rules over them and numbers them. The flocks, of course, are God's people. Messiah, the good shepherd, counting his sheep. Just as Moses, remember First Century Toolbox, the final, ultimate, great redeemer, he will be like the first redeemer. So Moses, the first redeemer, conducts a census, so too Messiah, the ultimate redeemer, will also. May we merit by God's grace to be numbered in that counting. The Midrash Tanakhuma. Love the Midrash Tanakhuma, by the way. It's great. I think I like it better than the Midrash, the larger Midrash. It comments on Numbers chapter 1, verse 4, and when it says, which says, "There shall be a man of each tribe, each one head of his father's household." The Tanakhuma says that the man in this verse refers to King Messiah, who is the ultimate head of the household, quoting Zechariah 6:12. "Behold, a man whose name is Branch." Branch is the name of the Messiah. That's why Nazareth in Hebrew means branch town, because they knew the Messiah would be coming from branch town. And so, "Behold, a man whose name is Branch." Isaiah 53:3, "A man of sorrows acquainted with grief." Messiah, the head of the tribes, the head of the household. And in Matthew 10, verse 25, Yeshua refers to himself as the head of the household. And so we have this great census of Messiah to look forward to. The host above and the host below. Verse 3. "From 20 years old and upward, whoever is able to go out to war in Israel, you and Aaron shall number them by their armies." Still a practice in the land of Israel, right? Everyone serves in the military. "That which is in heaven is reflected on earth. As above, so below." Fundamental principle. Traditional midrash in the book of Hebrews teach us that the tabernacle on earth is a copy of the true heavenly tabernacle above, the eternal dwelling place of the living God. We also have learned that when we were in the book of Leviticus, that the priesthood of the tabernacle below had an equivalent in the one above, namely the priesthood of the Messiah. And so earthly institutions that are ordained by the Torah have reflections in heavenly realities. This is true of the hosts of Israel as well. In Parashat Bamidbar, the Torah offers a long look at the hosts of Israel. We see them numbered and counted. We see them divided into tribal identities. We see them camped around the tabernacle. If that which is below is a reflection of that which is above, then the hosts on earth correspond to, what do you think, above? The heavenly hosts above. And the Midrash Rabbah, the encampments of Israel described in these passages, are said to correspond to the placement of the angels around God's throne. The mustering of the host of Israel can be compared to the mustering of the host of heaven. Adonai Sabaoth, right? One of the titles for Hashem, Adonai Sabaoth, Lord of hosts, Lord of armies, letting us know that he's got an element of him that is a God of warfare, and that he's got a legion. Okay, so what's below, and this counting here would count them for the armies, is reflecting Adonai Sabaoth and his hosts above. Chapter 19 of the book of Revelation offers us a glimpse of that future. There we see the Messiah as a commander of Hashem's hosts, prepared for battle. He rides at the head of the host of heaven. As in the beginning of the book of Numbers, the hosts of the Lord are arrayed for war, ready to swoop into action. The heavenly hosts that accompany Messiah into battle, many interpret or understand to be the angels, or the heavenly host, because there you kind of have this idea of the messianic age where heaven and earth are converging into one. So you got kind of a mixture. Numerous texts refer to Yeshua commanding those legions of angels. In the Gospels, Yeshua has 12 legions of angels at his disposal, the 12 legions corresponding to the 12 tribes, Revelation 19:14, armies which are in heaven clothed in fine linen, white and clean. But that's interesting, because fine linen, white and clean, doesn't describe angels. In the book of Revelation, what's that describe? It describes the Zadokim. The righteous ones. And so this ranks of heavenly cavalry mounted up on their white horses are not merely angels, but apparently also the righteous of the generations. And that's the righteous of the generations is a concept we've discussed before, each generation having Zadokim that kind of are the pillars that are keeping us all afloat. And it's biblical. Why? What kept the world afloat? Literally around Noah's time. One righteous man. Abraham, will you save this for 50? Yep. 40, 30, 20. I'll save it for one. Idea that a righteous person of the generation merits the salvation, the not damning of that generation, very biblical. And some of these are apparently in the book of Revelation part of this host. Numbering the 12 tribes. We'll skip ahead a little bit. Verses 45 and 46. So all the numbered men of the sons of Israel by their father's household from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war in Israel, even all the numbered men were 603,550. Yes, that is significant. Moses and Aaron counted the fighting men, numbered their hosts in the thousands and tens of thousands. The vast number revealed the census fulfilled what God had spoken to Abraham. Now look toward the heavens and count the stars if you are able to count them. So shall your descendants be. Moses reckoned the host of Israel as they prepared to enter the promised land as a fulfillment of the promise to Abraham. Because he said in Deuteronomy 10, verse 22, your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 persons in all. And now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven. In another passage, the Lord tells Abraham, Genesis 22:17, I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and the sand which is on the seashore. Now, let's test your rabbinic mind, your first century mind. Let me read that again. I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and the sand which is on the seashore. What two images of being multiplied are being used? Stars above and below. So on one hand, they're compared to sand and dust. On the other, they're compared to the stars of heaven. The rabbis had to deal with this. That's how they roll. Midrash Rabbah. Not as good as the Tanakhum, but good. Midrash Rabbah. For Bereshit, chapter 2, verse 13. They were compared to dust, and they are compared to stars. In this world, they are compared to dust. When referring to the world to come, they are compared to stars. As the stars sparkle throughout the firmament, so they will sparkle forever in the world to come. And similarly, in the book of Revelation, the hosts of the Lord appear above and below, like stars and dust. In Revelation 7, we read about a census. That was our Hebrew lesson. Much like the one taken in the wilderness by Moses. In that passage, the angel conducted a census of Israel and sealed 12,000 from every tribe, except Dan. We'll have to talk about that later. And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of the sons of Israel. So the tribes are counted on earth. The number is 144,000. 12 times 12,000, a poetic way of saying all of Israel. And in this way of expressing that the hosts below are finite. Immediately after witnessing the counting off of the 12 tribes, John looks in a vision, and what's he see? He sees one below that he can count. That's sand. But then he immediately sees hosts above, which he says he cannot count. Revelation 7, 9 and 10. After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could count. No one could do a census of. From every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands. And they cry out with a loud voice, saying, salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. So here are the hosts of heaven, the hosts above that correspond to the hosts below. Notice that Revelation 7 describes the tribes below and above, but while the tribes below are numerable, the hosts above are not. They are like the stars of heaven. In Genesis 15:5, now look toward the heaven and count the stars if you can. So shall your descendants be. Those that stand before the throne of God in heaven correspond to the encampment of the 12 tribes encircling the tabernacle that's described in the book of Numbers. So, if your mind can stretch, images in Revelation 7 is the above of Numbers 1. As below, so above. Every action below has a corresponding action above. The gathering around the tabernacle and the encounting of the host and getting everyone ready for battle, that's the below action of what John sees in 4D. Okay? And then hopefully I've pointed out enough verbal tallies and so forth, you can make this connection. But that's what's going on. That's your above and your below. So this is where the book of Numbers transcends and begins to give us a picture of the Messianic era, because it's dealing with the tabernacle again. Toward the sunrise, chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. Now those who camp on the east side toward the sunrise shall be the standard of the camp of Judah. So the host of Judah camped on the east side toward the sunrise, and they did so under the leadership of Nachshon, the son of Amminadab. We'll talk about him in a minute. According to the sages, the placement of the camp of Judah close to the sunrise is a sign of the Messiah. Midrash Rabbah, Bamidbar, chapter 2, verse 10. The Holy One, blessed be He, said to Moses, Moses, Judah will come on the eastern side, the direction from which light goes forth into the world, because the kingship of Messiah will go forth into the world from Judah. The coming of Messiah and the final redemption is often likened to the rising of the sun. Psalm 119, verse 5, compares the rising sun to a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. Bridegroom, another title for the Messiah. The prophet Malachi compares the Messiah to a rising sun when he says, Malachi 4, verse 2, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings. Isaiah 60, verse 1, the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Verse 3, nations will come to your light and kings to the brightness of your rising. And from the Talmud, this is from the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. Tractate Berakot, Folio 5b. Rabbi Chaya the Great and Rabbi Shimon the Kalafta were talking in the plains of the Arbel on the west side of the Sea of Galilee in the fading darkness before dawn. Rabbi Chaya the Great said to Rabbi Shimon ben Kalafta, Rabbi, this is just how the redemption of Israel will occur. At first it will happen little by little, but as it progresses it will grow and grow like the growing light before daylight, like the sun rising. From where do you derive this? The other said. He quotes Micah 7, verse 8. Though I dwell in darkness, the Lord is a light for me. So the placement of Judah, indication Messiah will come from Judah, be the light to the world. Sun rising. Nachshon, in the lead, not the land. In the lead. Again, Numbers 2, verses 3 through 4. Now those who camp on the east side toward the sunrise shall be the standard of the camp of Judah by their armies and the leaders of the sons of Judah, Nachshon, the son of Amminadab, and his army, even their numbered men. So as the Torah is describing the encampments of Israel, it also lists the marching order in which the tribes were to be set out. The Levites were commanded to carry the tabernacle at the center of the tribal ranks, or, if you know Hebrew, they were instructed to have the ark carry them. They don't carry the ark carries them in the Hebrew, by the way. A significant amount of this week's Torah portion is concerned with the details of dismantling and transporting the tabernacle. Under the leadership of Nachshon, Judah led the host of Israel. They shall set out first, because Messiah leads the way. The Torah said, that's chapter 2, verse 9, the standard of the camp of the sons of Judah, according to their armies, set out first, Nachshon, the son of Amminadab. Now, this is not the first time we've seen Nachshon. He's had a whole Torah Tuesday dedicated to him. Way back in Parashat Beishalach. Who is Nachshon?
He was the first one to cross the Red Sea.
And remember, we discussed that. And therefore, he was also the Messiah figure of that generation. He's the one that went through. You can go back and listen to that class and all of that because it's really cool. You can look at the archives, Parashat Beishalach in the Shadows class. He is the prince over the tribe of Judah. Gee, prince over the tribe of Judah. I don't think I have to get creative with that one, right? Again, Parashat Beishalach was where we met him. One thing we're being taught here, though, in the wilderness is Messiah must be the one who leads us. He must be the one that leads us through the sea. He must be the one that leads us through the wilderness. He must go first. Nachshon was a forefather, a foreshadow of the Messiah. His name is mentioned 6 times in the Torah. But you followers of Yeshua know 2 other times. They're in Yeshua's genealogy in Matthew 1 and Luke 3. He's not only a foreshadow and a fractal of the Messiah, he's an actual ancestor of the Messiah. In other words, Messiah actually had his genes, Prince of Judah. When the host above set out for war and conquest, just as below, what happened when they set out? The prince of Judah went up first and led them out. What will happen above in the great spiritual warfare of all time? The prince of the tribe of Judah will lead them out as a rider upon the horse, the Messiah, the one called faithful and true. Behind him follow the host of heaven, the encampment around the tabernacle above. The host of Israel below reflect the host above. When Messiah comes, an amazing thing happens. That which is above invades that which is below. And the host of heaven invade earth, and in so doing they bring that which is above down to earth. In other words, they bring heaven to earth. As the host of Israel marched forth in the wilderness, they carried the tabernacle with them. So too the host above bring with them the tabernacle of God, the eternal one, the one made flesh. By the end of the book of Revelation, the heavenly tabernacle is established on the earth as the holy city, the new Jerusalem. Revelation 21, verse 3. Behold, the dwelling place of God, the Mishkan, the tabernacle of God, is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be in them, among them. All right. So we'll close there. I think it's good stuff to chew on there. But in review, that very first part of the class is very important. We all have a wilderness, or we will all be in a wilderness, or we will all find ourselves in the wilderness. Do not run from the wilderness. Yes, at first it will seem like a place of death, and if you don't have Nachshon leading you, you will die. But it's also the place of provision, refreshment, refuge, revelation, and encounter with God. Book of Numbers sets out how to do that. Then also a connection that I've never seen in Christian sources of Numbers and Revelation above and below. One is describing the below chess moves. The other is describing when you move the chess piece below down here, that's what gets moved up there. Okay. And that'll go back to our discussions in Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. We spent several weeks on that above and below with the priesthood and the garments and the colors and how all of those connected. So those are still your tools. We're still using the same tools every week. Okay, to unlock these verbal tallies, above and below. Okay, these are our tools. Okay. All right, let's close with the blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Notein HaTorah. Blessed are you, Lord, the giver of the Torah. Amen.